This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Another PatCast here on Province Radio. Jeff Patterson joined by Province columnist Ed Willis, who I assume is buckled in here. Otherwise, he would be bouncing off the walls with draft lottery fever. You can't contain yourself.
Well, it's tempered also by the Whitecaps game last night. Yeah, you know, I'm up, I'm down. It's really hard. I've got to take my lesson from those hockey players. Even keel, don't get high, don't get too high, don't get too low.
Well, you got to bring 110% to the PatCast, Ed. But it is pretty, there was so little drama for 82 games of the regular season. It is kind of cool to think that we're, 48 plus hours now away from, you know, possibly altering the course of this franchise with one drop of the lottery balls.
And I know, because we want to be on the cutting edge of journalism here, I can reveal to you fantastic story. I talked to Trevor Linden late last night, and we talked for about 20 minutes. And my last question to him, I said, "Are you bringing anything lucky to the lottery?" And I hear this long pause, and he goes, "Why, yes, I'm bringing Pat Quinn's 1970-71 Canucks card with me." So I get this whole story. He's been in touch with Callie Quinn. Callie goes through her archives, digs out this card, sends it to him. So, I mean, I think this is such a special moment in Canucks history. The franchise that does so many things wrong, and I think they really have a chance to reverse karma here. But I thought that was such a lovely story, just because of the connection between Pat and Trevor in this franchise.
And that's why we bring you on the PatCast, is for stories like that one. But, you know, it is funny when you see it laid out like Botch did in the paper. You know, are they a cursed organization? And I know that people that have lived here long enough sometimes feel that way. But boy, when you see a list of it like that, you can't help but think that, yeah, there might just be a couple of black cats and some spilled salt somewhere along the way with this organization.
Yes, that's true. I think the larger question is how ineptly they've been managed by and large over the years, and that's kind of put them in a position where these things are magnified, where another organization just might be able to roll through those like speed bumps with the Canucks. They turn into these cataclysmic events. But yes, the overall evidence presented by, and there were things he didn't get into because I was reading them and I was going, oh, geez, remember this and remember that and all the crazy stuff. Owners suing owners, right. And generally, you know, Pat Quinn, the icon, getting fired, and then John McCaw phoning him the next day and asking him, well, would you mind coaching the team? Just crazy stuff like that, and it is part of the Canucks story, and I think they really have a chance to reverse something here at this lottery.
So what are you saying, that a couple of black cats could have done a better job managing this organization at times?
I'm saying a 12-year-old with a copy of the Hockey News draft probably could have drafted better than the Canucks have over the years. But they have, and I know the jury is still out, and I know there's a lot of questions about Jim Benning as a general manager, and yes, they're all greener than grass in their positions, but I like what they've done so far. I like the group they've assembled, and I'd like to see them move forward, and I'd like to see them have a shot at success.
All of that said, it is a numbers game. It's probability here. I mean, they've got their chance at the top pick, but the numbers don't, you know, favor them to land that first overall selection. Ed Willis, what's your gut tell you? Where are the Canucks going to wind up on Saturday afternoon?
Well, I believe the highest odds of probability of them to finish third. Now, that doesn't make them, you know, it doesn't mean it's over 50%. I believe it's 45. They pick in the top three, 55, they pick 3 through 6. I think that where they stay is the highest. It doesn't by any means that. So I'm just going to stick with that. I think they pick 3. I think they pick Jesse Puljujarvi. And I'm telling you, I've watched. Have you watched any of the under 18s?
I did, yeah.
If there are two players better in the draft than this kid, that's a pretty good draft. I mean, I didn't really watch him that closely in the World Junior, but I watched him closely in two games, and boy, he's got it all. He's the real deal.
Well, and that's how I look at things too. I mean, yes, perfect world, they win the draft lottery, they get Austin Matthews, but I think anything in the top three, if they sit if they stay where they are, anything in the top three represents a win for the Vancouver Canucks.
Now, I think the real interesting question is if they go 4-5, because Ylevi, the Finnish kid, looks for all the world, and I'm sorry, I'm just going on what all the pundits, but people whose opinion I trust, say he's a top-pairing defenseman. So if you're picking fourth or fifth, do you go Matthew Tkachuk, who looks like he's going to be a 30-goal first-line left winger, or do you go to the defenseman who might not have the same impact, but for the Canucks fills a better need? I think that's the more interesting question. Or do you trade down? And I think that scenario is very much in play for the Canucks. I know they love Jake Bean from Calgary.
Right. And again, I mean, we talk about the history of the Vancouver Canucks and J.J. Daigneau showing up on the podium on crutches, and now Jake Bean with a broken foot. So what's that thing about history repeating itself? But no, I mean, you're right. After three, to me, it's wide open. It gets fascinating. I know, in fact, when you talked to Jim Benning last week and wrote about it, he was out east, far east, you know, watching Pierre-Luc Dubois, the big kid who has, you know, had this great second half and has rocketed up the standings, and who couldn't use a 6'2", 6'3", you know, guy that can play the middle but play the wing, pretty versatile guy. So, yeah, I mean, there's lots of options. That's what's going to make, you know, if they land one of the top three picks here on Saturday, it's clean, it's easy, it's pretty much done, but it won't give us a whole lot to talk about. 4-6, you know, the next 2 months is set in terms of nothing but talking points from a media standpoint.
Well, yeah, and then the other part of this, Jeff, is just what a pivotal moment this is in Canucks history, because if they do land one of those top three picks, they have some nice pieces in place, but I don't think you can say there's a real franchise player in that group, a real legitimate game changer. But you add, you know, you add that guy into that mix, and all of a sudden, boy, you know, now you've got that guy, now you've got Bo Horvat, now you've got all the complementary pieces. Your goaltending looks like it's going to be fine for the next decade, knock on wood. So now all you really have to do is build your defense to be a respectable team. What I'm saying is if they get this right, I think the journey back towards respectability may be shorter than people think.
Right. And I look at that sort of twofold. One is the players that they've got, but the assets that they've got too. And you look at, you know, a team like Los Angeles Kings that had success through the players they drafted, but you know, Wayne Simmons was a Kings draft pick, and Braden Shen was a King. It allowed them to make the
Jack,
you know,
Johnson.
Exactly. Yeah. It allowed them to make the Jeff Carter and Mike Richards trades to come in and bolster a team and take them to the Stanley Cup and get them to that next level. So, yeah, you have to build around the pieces you've got, but you also have some flexibility if you continue to stockpile these great assets. So, again, it's fascinating on so many levels. It's going to be fun, but we'll start to get some answers on Saturday.
Right, now, you referenced the Los Angeles Kings. What was your takeaway from the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs, Jeff Patterson?
Well, shocked that the Anaheim Ducks are done. Not that the Nashville Predators beat the Anaheim Ducks, but the way it went down, the Ducks losing games 1 and 2 on home ice, and then another seventh game at home. I mean, they lose 3 of 4 on home ice, the pivotal games too. And look, I know that there isn't a lot of crying going on in this city for Ryan Kessler today. But, you know, I mean, Kessler did his part, 4 goals in the series. Although that was fascinating, too. You know, Ryan Kessler, 4 goals, no assists in a 7-game series. I mean, that's the Ryan Kessler that we saw here for the better part of a decade. But no goals from Corey Perry. Although Perry and Getzlaf, I think, had 21 shot attempts in Game 7. So it wasn't for lack of trying. But, yeah, I mean, wild on that side of the draw that the Kings and the Ducks, I mean, I think we all anticipated a second round that was going to have this Southern California showdown to it, and not so much. So, you know what? I like the San Jose Sharks story. I see it.
You know, you're not buying it completely?
Well, no. I mean, now it's wide open for them, at least
sure is,
through the next round.
Yeah.
No, I mean, Joe Thornton's been a great story this year in the way that he has performed at his age. And I see a lot of people that suggest, well, Thornton's doing it. You know, the Twins can do it too. And yes, Daniel and Henrik can bounce back, I suppose. But show me the Joe Pavelski, the Thomas Hurdle, the, you know, Jonas Donskoy. Show me Brent Burns on the Vancouver Canucks. You know, Thornton's he's got the complementary pieces that the Twins haven't had to work with here in the last couple of years. But, you know, Martin Jones is a good story. I mean, he's got his name on the Stanley Cup as a backup to Jonathan Quick, but he wants to get his name on there as the guy, and there were a lot of questions down the stretch. Were they going to start James Reimer? I never bought into that one, but good for Martin Jones. Like to see the local angle there. So, you know, I wasn't shocked that the Sharks beat the Kings. I just think it's funny, and we see this in sports, that, you know, teams are so good, but they kind of hit that, expiry date pretty quickly. And there's just a lot of guys on the Los Angeles Kings that we've watched perform at a high level for a while that they just weren't able to get it there here in this playoff run.
Yeah, well, I was shocked the Sharks beat the Kings. And when I look at that Kings team, it's kind of young veterans, guys. And they're really their mid to late 20s for the most part, a few exceptions. But for the most part, you would think these guys are in their prime. And there is so much depth. It's not like, with the exception of Drew Doughty, which we can have a longer conversation about, it's not like they play the crap out of you. You know, you've got Carter, you've got Kopitar, you've got a top six that's buttressed by guys like Kyle Clifford, very useful players. I just thought they had, you know, the ability to withstand anything thrown at them. But geez, San Jose exposed them so quickly. I mean, you know, and I wrote this on Sunday, you know, in the fight game, they always talk about a boxer getting old in one night, and that's, to me, what it looked like with the Kings. It looked like they got old in that series. San Jose was faster. There was more creative. They were far deeper. I thought, you know, I thought that fourth line for San Jose was a massive difference maker, and Marty Jones was the better goalie. And actually, all they needed was a saw off there. They needed not to be beaten by Jonathan Quick, but Marty Jones was the better goalie. So, I'm not sure if they're announcing themselves as the next great power. I don't think you can make that case. But for a franchise who's been around it as long as San Jose does, and I've known Doug Wilson. We used to play junior golf together in Ottawa, so I've known him for a long time. And I'm happy for him and happy for this organization that has done a lot of right things over the years and finally has something to show for it.
Yeah, and I think, too, from the Kings' standpoint, you know, we talk about depth and this team on defense beyond Drew Doughty, just nowhere close to what it was even 4 years ago. And I remember talking to Daryl Sutter about this, because for the rest of my life, I don't think, and Daryl sort of backed me up on this one. I mean, that 2012 Kings team that beat the Canucks as an eighth seed and then went on to the Cup, you know, they used the same six defensemen for all 20 playoff games. They didn't ever have to take a guy out of the lineup due to injury or ineffectiveness. You know, I mean, just think of that from a coaching standpoint, the certainty you've got in the six guys that you just trot out there night after night. And they had, you know, guys like Willie Mitchell, obviously, and Matt Green, those stay-at-home solid guys that allowed Drew Doughty to be Drew Doughty and know that he could roam the ice and know that the store was being minded and didn't have to worry so much about the defensive game. And really, since then, you know, there's just been sort of a slight decline, and Martinez and Muzzin are good players, but you know, they've had to, it's life in the salary cap, right? They've had to fill around the edges with some guys that aren't as good as they used to have.
They never replaced Alex Voinov, you know, and in this narrative, you know, and that's a huge story, because he was kind of a poor man's Doughty. You know, good in his old end, gave him some offense, and it just gave them a little different look back there. And to me, they had too many big, muscular kind of 80s-type defensemen, crease clears, hard off the glass, but couldn't play the transition game. And like I said, they were exposed by that Sharks lineup. They just, way too many Shens and McNabs, and, you know, and they were all of a type. And Muzzin is a little higher-level player, but he's that type, too.
Right, and you're seeing, and even with the Chicago Blackhawks, you know, you can have three really good defensemen, but you need three other guys, and they've got to play even a little bit, and that's where teams are able to expose you and capitalize. I don't know how you look at playoff hockey, but one of the things I love the most is getting to see guys that maybe we haven't watched on a nightly basis throughout the regular season do their thing. And it was one of the things, I mean, who in their right mind would watch the New Jersey Devils night in, night out during a regular season? But then you knew how great Scott Niedermeyer was, but then you got to see him, you know, when the stakes were the highest, perform, and you were just awed, and okay, that's why this guy is as good as he is. And I know we're only, you know, a day into the second round, but I've sort of had this feeling watching John Tavares do his thing as well. I don't watch the Islanders on a nightly basis. Not a lot of people do. But I just love how hard the guy competes. There in the big moments, obviously, when they needed him in Game 7 the other night to get the job done. And, you know, it's fun. I mean, he's one of those emerging superstars that maybe doesn't have the cachet of everybody else, but Still a treat to watch, and has, I mean, as he's, we sit here right now, he's leading the National Hockey League playoffs in scoring.
Well, let me throw another name at you, Alex Pietrangelo, who yep. I think really emerged as an elite defenseman in that series against Chicago, because I thought he was better than both Duncan Keith and Brent Seabrook, and that's saying a lot in the playoffs. He's another guy on a little slightly different, but I had no idea Donskoy was as good as he is. And for him to be playing in the bottom six of that lineup, boy, it gives them such an edge to have that scoring threat. And he scored so many big goals against Los Angeles. Not only he looked like a threat every time he was on the ice. I'm just kind of trying to think of something. You raise a terrific point there about those guys, and especially the guys back east, because nobody really wants to stay up to watch them all. And the other guy in praise, I know he's not back east, but Laterra is a terrific two-way centerman for St. Louis. I think St. Louis kind of has that look about them that they might be the team this year. Yep. I just don't see any holes, and I see depth, and I can see a team that can play it anyway. So I think it'll be really interesting when they're coming up against Dallas, and Dallas will throw a lot of speed at them, and maybe they can expose them. And I just like the way St. Louis looked, and they've had the baptism of fire by fire now.
Right, and how many times have we seen that? I mean, it's kind of become a little bit of an adage in the National Hockey League, at the very least, where, you know, sometimes that first round is the toughest one.
Sure,
and I think back to, you know, Calgary in 04 took the Canucks to seven games, went in overtime, Marty Jelena scores. That's the opening round. You know, the Flames get there, and then they get on this run, and they get to the Stanley Cup final. I know they didn't win it. And then even the Canucks in 2011. I mean, you know, you think of the drama. We just passed the five-year anniversary of Slay the Dragon and Alex Burrow's goal. But, you know, you just bust it in that first round, and you wonder, okay, do you have anything left? But sometimes, you know, teams are able to sort of build off that and get on a bit of a run. And I do have that feeling now with the St. Louis Blues, especially with the way things have fallen around them now that, you know, there's no Blackhawks anymore. Mm-hmm. And they beat the Blackhawks, but the Kings and the Ducks are gone. It's certainly there for the St. Louis Blues. They've just got to find a way to harness it. But as you mentioned, I mean, from the top to the bottom. I mean, they've got the top end guy. Tarasenko has just become appointment viewing now with the puck's on his stick.
Yeah.
But right down to the, you know, I like their fourth line. And say what you want about a guy like Steve Ott. During the regular season, he drives guys wild. He probably drives coaches nuts as well. But, you know, there's still a place in the game for a veteran guy who's been through the battles on a fourth line. You know, Kyle Brodziak is a guy I remember going back to even Edmonton days where
very
just responsible.
Useful,
you know,
player.
Rarely hurts you. And it just plays hard and kind of guy you need at this time of the year. So, yeah, I mean, as I sit here right now, I kind of have my eye on Washington and I've got my eye on St. Louis, and I'd be okay if that was the Stanley Cup final. I mean, two pretty compelling and intriguing, you know, franchises that haven't had a lot of playoff success of late.
I like Pittsburgh in the East. Yeah. I think Pittsburgh is St. Louis East. I think, you know, they exercised a lot of demons in that first round. I mean, they took apart, still, I understand the Rangers were hurt, but they're still a formidable opponent, and they took them apart quite easily. They've just got firepower, and whatever it is Mike Sullivan is preaching, they are buying. Every time I look behind the bench and I think of him back that lost year under Torts in Vancouver, and you know, he came in as a reputation as a guy. This is an NHL head coach who just happens to be an assistant coach right now. Didn't really see it that year, but we're seeing it now, that's for sure.
Well, you're saying Pens, I'm saying Caps. I mean, the networks and the league couldn't have asked for a whole lot more. Sidney Crosby on one side, Ovechkin on the other, and both playing pretty well, doing their things. I mean, the Capitals have shown this year that they're more than just Alexander Ovechkin, but he's still the guy there, and it's great to see. It's good for hockey to see Sidney Crosby back and performing well and looking like he's having fun. He's got that look in his eye that, you know, I mean, he may be unstoppable. We'll find out, but this is a heck of a second-round matchup.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, as you said, isn't it funny because remember how the NHL almost twisted themselves into an orgasmic knot the first time the Penguins and Caps met in the play. How long ago was that? Well, like, geez, like, Ovi has gray in his hair now. Sid can actually grow a beard. And here we are. I mean, it was supposed to be like a generational rivalry, and it never really panned out, but we're going to get a real nice taste of it here.
But you mentioned the Rangers for a sec, and I mean, you know, the one thing with the Rangers you just expect is goaltending. They didn't seem to get it from Henrik Lundqvist, and not ready to write him off just yet, but I thought it was interesting this week. in the aftermath and the locker cleanout day, we all saw the stories, and I'm sure many people saw the video of Dan Boyle, you know, refusing to speak to the media as a whole until Larry Brooks and there was one of his colleagues at the New York Post left the scrum. I'm just wondering, you've been at this game for a while. Any run-ins with players? Anybody call you on anything that you've written along the lines?
Nothing that public. There have been a couple of private meetings. Todd Bertuzzi, but which hardly put me in an exclusive club. I got into it with Keith Tkachuk a couple of times in Winnipeg. But actually, I'm pretty good friends with Keith right now. So most of my best stories involve covering the Western Hockey League. And I'm sure you can relate to them. I'll give you a couple of them. My first year covering the Medicine Hat Tigers, 82-83, and the Lethbridge Broncos had this powerhouse, and they were coached by John Chapman. Well, don't the Tigers beat them? I'm sorry, it's the second year. Don't the Tigers beat them? And the Tigers are on a bit of a run, and they're in first place. So I go to interview Chapman after the game, and his famous quote is, he compares a certain part of it. He says, if the Medicine Hat Tigers are a first-place team, then this part of my anatomy is a machine gun. Russ Firewall clips it off. He sends a Ted Chanel to the WHL office. Chappie gets fined $500, and he's not very happy about it. So they come into town shortly thereafter, and I go, look, you know, I got to do this. I got it because, you know, this, I think, in my mind, this is a defining moment in my career. If I back down from John Chapman now, it'll get out, and I'll have zero credibility. So I go up to him after the game, and I go, John, have you got a minute? And he looks at me, and he goes, have you got $500? And I go, no. And he goes, well, I guess I don't have a minute. At least it was a good line. The other one I had was involved Ian McKenzie, who was a scout with the Calgary Flames for years and years. And there was an very famous All-Star game in Brandon because it was the year Mike Modano broke his wrist in his draft year. He had one client, and it was Modano. And it was this guy named, I'm trying to remember his name, it was Howard somebody, and he was from Livonia, and he was a family friend and the lawyer and everything. And I remember him, like, watching him, Modano goes down, he's holding his, this guy sprints around in the Eastern Conference with an ice bag in his hand. So, anyways, there's a big party, and I've arranged to talk to Ian McKenzie because the Flames have done such a fantastic job of drafting. This is late 80s, right? The Flames have done such a fantastic job of drafting. Ian stays out the whole night partying with his scouting friends, and you know that can be a fearsome sight. So I meet him. We have this appointment for breakfast, and I meet him, and I look at him, and he goes, you know, Ian, we don't have to do this now. And he's quite lucid, you know, it's worn off. And he goes, no, I can do this. So we do it, and in the leader post, we ran it, these things as Q&A. So I'm just asking him some questions, and I ask him a question about, you know, why does a team like Calgary draft so well, and why does a team like Toronto not draft so well? And his quote is, if you treat your scouts like turkeys, you draft turkeys. This ends up on, I'm trying to remember who the general manager was for the league. I'm sorry, it ends up on Cliff Fletcher's desk. Fletcher and McKenzie go back to Atlanta. They're close friends. The story I get is Cliff hauls him in, threatens to fire him. You can't be saying that. It was Gord Stellick was the Toronto GM. He's the guy who sent it. Okay. So that's it. So now we flash forward to the Memorial Cup, and we're at a gathering afterwards, and I see Ian there, and it's the same thing. I go, look, I've got to defuse this. I've got to go up to him. I go up to him and go, Ian, like, I'm sorry. Is there anything? And he looks at me and goes, no, it's my fault. Well, 2 hours later, the party's breaking up. And I watch Ian McKenzie in the middle of Ron DeLorme and four or five other guys, and he's swinging his fist like a mild man. He's going, let me at him. I'll kill him. And I'm watching this, and I'm going, boy, he is really upset. I wonder who he's mad at. Something must have happened over there. And they walk by, and they get him in the elevator, and as the minute the elevator door closes, this little light bulb goes on over. Oh, that's me he wanted to kill. So that's it. Those are my two stories.
That's pretty good. Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Todd Bertuzzi off the top because Matt Cook was a guy here who...
Prickly, yeah.
And to his credit, look, it's a give and take. I mean, you know, we've got the pen or the microphone. We say what we say. I think you got to be prepared to have some guys come back at you. Yep. And Matt Cook was a guy who, you know, for all these guys that claim they don't read or they don't listen or watch TV, whatever, I mean, Matt Cook would recite what I had said on the post-game show on radio. I mean, he must have been listening on his way home. He'd come back to practice the next day.
Or somebody was listening for him and interpreting it, which is something I have found over the years.
And I've run into those issues as well. But but no, I think Matt was, I mean, he was a guy that, you know, he had his the antenna up. And, it was something I had said about Todd Bertuzzi. And boy, he, you know, he did it politely and professionally. But he was backing his boy and his teammate. And you know, I thought, okay, fair enough. I mean, it's out there. It's on the public airwaves. He's allowed to listen to the radio. That was really otherwise. I mean,
okay, we can't have this conversation without talking about Berkey for a bit. Did you have any run-ins with Brian?
Yeah, I mean, nothing famous. I mean, I think I was pretty still in the infancy of my time here in Vancouver. He had other targets, bigger fish to fry, if you will. So, I mean, I had a few that he called me on some things, but nothing that really jumps out at me.
Yeah, we don't have enough time to get into them all. What killed me about Brian is he would preface each one of his phone calls. Brian, now you know I don't read the paper, and then off he'd go, and I finally snapped on him and said, Brian, these conversations would go a lot better if you actually read the paper and would form your own opinion instead of what somebody in the PR department told you, which led to the usual exchange of whatever. But the thing about Brian I loved was you could have these knockdown, and you know I gave it to him as good as and it was forgotten. Next day, I had, how are you doing? That was it. He really did not hold a grudge as long as you showed up and, you know, and did your job. I don't even want to get into it.
Well, it's funny when you say, you know, did he see it or did somebody tell him about it? Yeah. And you were telling Western League stories. You know, when I was doing games, broadcasting games, and, you know, you'd be out on the road. And this is pre-internet when I was broadcasting the games in Kamloops. And so, you know, you're out wherever. You're on the prairies. You're doing the game back to Kamloops.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm trying to describe what I see on the ice, and the number of times guys would come up to me after a game, what did you say? I didn't lose that fight. What are you talking about? And I'd look at the guy, and he's like, I just talked to my girlfriend.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah. You know, guys, you'd see them in the bank of payphones after the game. And again, this is the era we were in then. But, you know, guys would phone. They'd phone their parents. They'd phone their billets. They'd phone their girlfriends. They'd phone their agents. Mm-hmm. And through,
that's right.
And it was, I mean, that's how information traveled. Or, you know, they weren't able to listen to the games on the internet or whatever. You know, so these guys would get these secondhand accounts of what was going on. So a few times I had to try to put out fires based on reports these guys were getting from their girlfriends back home.
When I think of the access we had to those guys and some of the characters, you know, both in, you know, the good and the bad sense and how rich it was, I really wish my skills would have been a little more developed because there would have been a fabulous book
sure,
about that era and the inner workings of the league and, you know, great stories, tragic stories, uplifting stories, but just amazing stories and amazing people all, you know, against the backdrop of, for the most part, these small prairie towns, which it just made them all the richer, in my view.
I just want to finish up here, and we've talked about Mark Crawford era Vancouver Canucks. Let's talk about Crow himself. You know him reasonably well, all of us North Shore dwellers. and saw him at a couple of games here down the stretch late in the regular season. I know he made the rounds, and he's putting himself out there. Ottawa's job is available.
Yep.
I think we all anticipate that there will be an opening in Anaheim here before too long. Do you see Mark getting another shot as a head coach in the National Hockey League, or might he have to be prepared to do the Rick Bowness thing at this stage of his career, which is kind of a senior assistant coach?
Real interesting question. In my view, he's a lot closer to the front of the line than he was when he went to Zurich. And I had a really interesting conversation with him, and he looked at me and he said, look, it's all because of the kid. He's starting to get interviewed. He's starting to get calls because he coached Austin Matthews this year. And that brought so much attention on that. Just to backtrack a bit, I spent 6 days in Zurich this summer. Staying at Mark's apartment. He was gracious enough to lend it to me and my wife. And Zurich's a fantastic
city. He wasn't there.
No, he wasn't. but the Zurich Lions are kind of the Montreal Canadiens of the Swiss League. They have most money, most prestigious, most powerful, and play in the biggest market. So when he went there, you know, there was a bit of a light shone on him. But when Austin Matthews went there, all of a sudden the hockey world is looking at him. They look at the way the kid developed. All of a sudden, you know, people remember and they start looking at Mark's resume and they go, geez, you know, he won a Stanley Cup when he was a real young guy. did good work in Vancouver until, you know, the best before date showed up there. You can't really hold him accountable for Dallas and Los Angeles. You know, this might be a guy. I think he's just, you know, he's done enough and he's kind of stayed out that it's funny the way these things go. And I've never been able to put my finger on it, but you just get a feel for when a guy becomes a legitimate candidate again. And I think he's there. Now, it could be he might have to do that associate coach thing for a year or two to get back in. But I think he's going to get some long looks, and I can see some fits, some real good fits for him.
Yeah, and I think the Austin Matthews thing certainly helped him. But I think his willingness to go and ply his trade overseas rather than sit by the phone here at home just waiting and thinking that I've got a Stanley Cup, you know, somebody should be calling me. You know, he backed up, moved halfway around the world. That's not easy for a guy to do, a family guy at that. And, you know, I think that tells hockey people sort of how serious he is about getting in there and getting one last shot. I say one last shot. I mean, you look at history. I mean, there aren't a lot of guys to get five chances with five different organizations to be a head coach, but there are some. And so, you know, I like the fact that he's kind of stepped away, reinvented himself a little bit. He's talked at length about how he's grown, and, you know, he's an emotional guy, and I think that made him successful, but there are times where you got to be able to rein that in too. And I'd be curious to see what, you know, Mark Crawford 2.0 looks like behind an NHL bench.
Is he going to be Summer Crow year?
Exactly. Right?
Now, yes. And again, like I'm not going to say I'm bosom buddies with him, but I think I know him reasonably
pretty good
well.
Read on him. Yeah.
And I think that temper, that emotional engagement got the better of him far too many times. And I think he'd tell you the same thing. And, you know, he needs to bring that level of intensity. He's just got to smooth it out a bit. I just don't think you can be that volatile when you're the leader of a group. There are times, but you get one or two of those, and he just lived there too often. And I think the older and wiser Mark Crawford realizes that. Having said all that, he's one of my favorite guys in the game to talk to because he's got a tremendous sense of humor. It's self-deprecating, and he really does see the big picture well. He's a smart guy. So I'd like to see him get another chance if it works out. Whether it works out or not, I know not. But I think just kind of the things are pointing in that direction for him.
Yeah, and I look at Ottawa. I think there could be a decent fit there. You know, Canadian market. He can certainly handle himself. The media demands.
I always thought Montreal would be a fit for him.
Yeah, it doesn't really make sense yet to start worrying about the Anaheim job because it's not available. Mm-hmm. But I just don't know how the Ducks could bring back Bruce Boudreau. And, you know, I guess we'll have to wait and see what else happens. I mean, right now there's just the one job, but as time marches on here, there'll probably be a couple of other coaching vacancies around the National Hockey League. We shall see. Well, if nothing else, listeners are 30 minutes closer to the National Hockey League draft lottery, Ed. So hopefully we've effectively...
We'll have so much more to talk about next time.
Oh, my goodness.
We should really plug. We're going to be at the Steel Toad next week, and I think we're going to go over the, you know, scenarios presented by the draft lottery, have a look at what this means to the Canucks, what the likely things are looking forward. And the playoffs will be a little deeper now, and I think a few more things will have taken shape. So, you know, there'll be lots to talk about.
Yeah, we'll take the show on the road to the Steel Toad on Wednesday night. Certainly encourage people to come down and join us, make it a fully interactive event. We had some fun the last time we were down there recording the video panel, so we'll do that again, and we'll make sure that we tweet out details if you're interested in joining us at the Steel Toad on West 2nd in Vancouver. Well, thanks as always. Appreciate you coming in doing this, the PatCast on Province Radio. You can find the PatCast and all Province Radio programming on iTunes. Search Province Radio, and of course, you find the links on our website as well. Ed, thanks for doing this.
All the best, Jeff.
There you go. Ed Willis of the Province Sports joining us here with another PatCast in the books on Province Radio.